my name is John Chung. Thank you for listening to Totally Awesome Films, where I discuss some of the greatest films ever made. Each week I watch a movie, talk about what I thought of the movie, research a little bit about how it got made, and discuss why I think the film is totally awesome. Today we're going to talk about the film Moonraker, and if you notice at the end of The Spy Who Loved Me, the credits clearly said James Bond will return in For Your Eyes Only. However, after the massive success of Star Wars, Albert Broccoli became fascinated by the financial potential of science fiction and immediately changed plans to make the next Bond film a science fiction story. So, looking at Ian Fleming's books, he realized one of the books had the word moon in the title and decided to use that. Now, in the book, Moonraker is the name of a nuclear missile, not a space shuttle. And, you know, it was written in 1955, way before the space race. However, Drax is the name of the bad guy. And incidentally, a moonraker is a nautical term. It's what the sailors call the top uppermost sail of a fully rigged ship. In fact, the book was so different from the film that Eon commissioned another novelization, again written by screenwriter Christopher Wood. It was called James Bond and the Moonraker, and it is the second official movie novelization after James Bond, The Spy Who Loved Me. So Albert Broccoli poured $34 million into the budget. This is more than the combined budget of the first six Bond films, and almost more than the combined budget of the last four films. Now, whatever you thought of the movie, he really wasn't wrong to do this, because despite some of the poor reviews, the film was a breakout box office success. It made $210 million, breaking all previous James Bond box office records. And it would hold on to that record for another 16 years until it was finally beaten by GoldenEye, way ahead in 1995. So the record held for 16 years. Now, when you adjust for inflation, it is still one of the top money-making films. And to this day, it is second only to Thunderball and Goldfinger and almost tied for You Only Live Twice as the top money-making film. And this includes all the films to come thereafter. Now, whether you like this movie or not, you can't doubt that the trend hopping on Star Wars was a good idea from a financial point of view. Now, we're going to see the introduction of two Bond heavyweights that make their entrance in this film. The first is Michael G. Wilson, who starts here as the executive producer. He was Cubby Broccoli's assistant in the last movie, and he is Cubby Broccoli's stepson. He's also a Stanford lawyer and a pretty smart guy, and he will eventually rise to take over Eon Productions and eventually helm the entire James Bond franchise with his half-sister, Barbara Broccoli. Another name to watch out for is John Glenn, not the astronaut, but the director. He is the editor here, but he's going to get a promotion in the next film and become the head director for Your Eyes Only, Octopussy, A View to a Kill, The Living Daylights, and License to Kill. Now, I have to admit, after I saw For Your Eyes Only and Octopussy in the theaters back in the early 1980s, I was a teenager. I started going back and watching the old Bond films, and this one would frequently pop up on cable television, and I'd watch it, you know, and I gotta admit, I really wasn't a fan of this movie. And it's no secret that critics pan this movie. And even today, most fans will list Moonraker as one of the worst 007 films. And that's too bad, because I feel underneath the mess of the silly camp and the weird scenes exists a potentially solid Bond film. Now, as an adult, I saw this movie again about 10 years ago, you know, well into the Pierce Brosnan James Bond era, and well into my James Bond fandom. And I thought this movie was completely idiotic. And again, I happened to see it again just a few years ago, and then I really hated it. Although, I have to admit then, I did notice some genuinely good moments as well. You know, the overall story, it's a pretty valid story. The action scenes are effective. The Bond girl is pretty strong and beautiful. And the villain is pretty menacing. So I just wanted to say that this movie isn't all bad. And after all, it holds a respectable 62% on Rotten Tomatoes. I really feel that in the spine of this movie is a potentially good movie hiding out. You know, the problem is there are some really bad moments. Or rather, should I say, there are some really non-Bond moments in this movie. Now, the last time I talked about The Spy Who Loved Me as a remake of Lewis Gilbert's earlier film, You Only Live Twice. Well, I feel that Moonraker is also a remake of both The Spy Who Loved Me and You Only Live Twice, with a little Dr. No thrown in for good measure. I mean, compare the space station scene with the hollowed-out volcano fortress, and you'll really see some similarities. And like Dr. No, Bond dresses up like in the villain's men's uniforms and poses as the villain's employees in order to infiltrate the lair. And yeah, that's kind of become a cliche and kind of a James Bond trope. Now, let me confess something like a weird personal secret. Now, remember, I hated this film as a child. I didn't care for this, even when I saw it a few years ago. And I've always listed this as one of my least favorite Bond films. So here's the weird thing. I did watch this movie today in preparation for today's podcast, and I have to admit, today, I kind of liked it, you know? I don't know if it's because I had all my expectations so lowered, or maybe today I'm just in a silly, stupid mood. I don't know what it is, but I have to admit, I kind of had a good time watching it today. So don't get me wrong, it is a stupid Bond movie, and there are a lot of cringeworthy moments. But I gotta admit, it was a very watchable movie, and some of the cringeworthy moments are actually so bad, they actually kind of became good. So what do you call an overall decent movie with occasional scenes that are so bad that they're good? Well, I think you end up with a very entertaining piece of crap, and this really is very entertaining at the least. So let's talk about what's good about this movie. First, the opening teaser. Now, James Bond is thrown off of an airplane and has to fly over to another parachuter and fight for this parachute, takes the parachute off, you know, steals it basically, and survives, only to be pursued by Jaws, who's also pursuing him in midair. And this is a great scene. And like most of the great Bond action scenes, you know, like the ski jump in The Spy Who Loved Me, the record-breaking boat jump in Live and Let Die, the mid-air car twist jump in The Man with the Golden Gun, and of course the recent tower fight scene in the opening teaser of Casino Royale, all those scenes were actually really done. They were not special effects. And like that, this opening parachute scene was not a special effect. It was really done. Now, occasionally they do cut to Roger Moore, but for the most part, actors really did this stunt. The scene was actually shot in free fall by two stuntmen, Jake Lombard and BJ Wirth, and they actually performed the fight choreography in air during free fall, plummeting 100 miles an hour more toward the earth. Jake Lombard wore a dummy parachute over a suit which had a real parachute under a suit, and the suit was actually kind of a breakaway suit so that he could activate that without having to take off the suit. And there was a third diver who also had a camera mounted on his helmet. And the thing is, when you factor in setting up and the actors getting ready to fight and do the fight, they were only able to film about 2 to 3 seconds of footage per jump. And so the entire sequence took a total of 88 jumps and 5 weeks just to produce 2 minutes of what you see in the opening teaser. Now, however, if you've seen this movie, you're probably thinking exactly what I'm thinking, which is that the intensity of this awesome action scene is somewhat compromised by the ending when you have Jaws pull his cord, the chute doesn't open, and then he tries to like flap his arms and like wings like trying to fly, and then he falls into a circus tent and still survives. You know, I thought it was kind of a stupid way to end a potentially awesome scene. And that act of inserting a comedic scene that sort of undermines a potentially awesome scene will become a theme and kind of serve as a metaphor for the entire movie. Now, what else does this movie have going for it? Well, it has Michael Lonsdale, who is great as Hugo Drax. He has this commanding and dominating presence that almost seems to swallow James Bond in every scene that he's in. And we really believe that this man can conquer the business world and become a billionaire businessman. He kind of has this calm confidence that's brilliantly played by Michael Lonsdale, very underplayed. And he just has this menacing, believable presence. And his launch to kill a toxin that kills people but leaves animals alive is weird, but it is perfectly within the bounds of some of the past Bond villains. The Bond girl is played by Lois Childs, and despite her ridiculous name, Holly Goodhead, she is a pretty good counterpart to R007, and more than holds her own as 007, and she has this kind of smoldering intensity, and I think she does hold her own as Bond's supposed equal. And unlike Denise Richards, she is believable as a PhD physicist, and also believable as a CIA agent posing as a PhD physicist. There are also some genuinely great James Bond moments. I love the scene where Hugo Drax invites 007 to do some pheasant hunting. And meanwhile, the sniper is climbed up a tree in the woods and is aiming to kill James Bond. Now, Bond follows the pheasants flying and shoots at the birds and apparently misses. And Drax tells him, "You missed, Mr. Bond." And Bond coolly says, "Did I?" And then you see a sniper fall dead from the tree. I mean, that's a great scene. Also, the moment where Drax realizes that his assistant, Corinne DeFore, has betrayed him, he has her killed by having her chased by dogs. Now, I don't remember much about seeing this movie when I was 10 years old in the theaters, but for some reason, I still remember this scene. It's burned into my memory, and it's a very chilling scene, very, very effective, and it just has this spooky feeling of like a late 1970s horror film. And also, just cinematically, it tells you all you need to know about the character of Drax. I also really like some of Bond's gadgets. I thought the cigarette case with an X-ray was cool. I mean, it allows Bond to crack that open that safe, and just a great idea. I also like the lighter that was really a miniature camera, pretty common nowadays, but I imagine very ahead of its time in 1979. I also liked some of Agent Holly Goodhead's gadgets, the pen with a hypodermic needle filled with poison, the date book that shoots poison darts, and a perfume bottle that's really a flamethrower. And I loved how when Bond catches Holly Goodhead with these items, he's just totally familiar with them and nonchalantly says, "Standard CIA issue." So I thought that was pretty clever writing. Unfortunately, there are bad parts in this movie. So again, like Guy Hamilton, who was hot off the directorial success of Goldfinger, Diamonds Are Forever, and Live and Let Die, decided to lose his mind with A Man with a Golden Gun, and we sense a possible similar course happened with Lewis Gilbert, although not as bad. So hot off of You Only Live Twice and The Spy Who Loved Me, we feel that he's given free rein and decides to let go. And again, he does go a little nuts. So while there were a few eye rolls, the first true groan-inducing moment comes in the middle of the film. And so in Spy Who Loved Me, we had a Lotus, which turned into an awesome submarine. And here we have a Venetian gondola, which turns into a hovercraft, driving down the streets of Venice while onlookers look on and do comedic double takes. You have a pigeon, which does this really fake double take, you know, and I don't know. I'm sure Gilbert was trying to recall the Lotus in some ironic and campy manner. You know, in the last car, we had a car turn into a submarine. Well, in this film, we have a boat that turns into a car. Well, the thing is, a Lotus that turns into a submarine is totally badass, but a gondola that turns into a car is completely lame. Next, you can't talk about this movie without talking about the name of the Bond girl, Holly Goodhead. I mean, sexual innuendo is one thing, but smacking the viewers in the face is another, and it's a rule of screenwriting not to draw attention to the script. But the name is so campy, so on the nose, that we're pulled out of the narrative dream of the film. We have to roll our eyes and groan. Again, too bad, because she is a pretty strong Bond girl, especially for that time. The next disaster is Jaws. And as the villain from The Spy Who Loved Me, he was so popular, I guess they had to bring him back. And it doesn't really make sense why he's in this movie, if you really think about it. I mean, why is he working for Drax? Did Drax put out an ad to hire all of Stromberg's employees? Or, I don't know, it's just kind of weird that he would show up working for Drax. I mean, it's not like the James Bond villains have some employee exchange program or something like that. So it is just weird. But you got to suspend our disbelief. And we can, I guess I can accept the fact that somehow he's working for Drax. However, in this movie, he becomes the comedic foil and is completely neutered. And he kind of becomes the butt of all the jokes. You know, he, after crashing a cable car, he then falls in love. And with a moan, he becomes a good guy. And that is an interesting choice. And apparently what happened is that, you know, Gilbert originally wanted Joss to stay a villain, but Gilbert started receiving so many fan mail, a lot of them from kids, asking why Joss couldn't be a good guy, that he started paying attention and decided, okay, well, we'll do this for the kids, and made Joss a good guy. Kind of a cool story, though, is that, you know, the director wanted Joss to fall in love, created this character Dolly, who was played by an actress named Blanche Ravalek. And after filming, the producers saw it, and they were worried. They were worried that fans would not believe that Joss, someone who's that tall, could have such a short girlfriend. Therefore, they considered reshooting the film, hiring a much taller actress, someone closer in height to Richard Kiel. However, Richard Kiel, who himself is 7'2.5", showed a picture of his actual wife, and his wife is the same height as Dolly. And when they saw that, I guess the producer decided, okay, I guess it is believable, and decided to keep the actress Blanche Ravalek as Dolly in the film. And that is who you see when you watch this movie. So I thought that was a pretty cool part on the actor, Richard Kiel. Another thing is the Chinese assassin Chang, played by the Aikido master Toshiro Suga. Now, apparently, how he got cast is that he is Michael G. Wilson's Aikido instructor and friend. Michael G. Wilson is Cubby Broccoli's stepson and is going to take over Eon Productions and the Bond franchise in the future. Now, here's my problem with the character of Chang. I have no problem with the actor Toshiro Suga, just the character of Chang. Now, if you're a master swordsman and you're going to kill, the world's most dangerous government assassin, why wouldn't you take a sword? Why in heaven's name would you take a lightweight kendo bamboo stick? I mean, those things are designed so that if you hit your opponent, you don't hurt them. They are not deadly weapons. Also, has anyone heard of Chekhov's gun? It's a dramatic principle made famous by the Russian short story novelist Anton Chekhov, who said, and I quote, translated from Russian, "If in the first act you have hung a pistol on the wall, then in the following one it should be fired." Well, I came up with Chekhov's vase, which says, if you show an expensive vase, you tell the audience how much the vase is worth, in this case, millions of dollars, and then spend a few seconds on the shot of the vase, then you know that in the next scene, that vase is going to get shattered. Also, when we get to Brazil and into Drax's stronghold, like Dr. No, like You Only Live Twice, like The Spy Who Loved Me, we get a sense that James Bond kind of crosses the looking glass once more, and he enters, again, a surreal sort of technicolor fantasy land. It's true here as well. Drax's Brazilian stronghold is surreal and almost dizzy. And I actually thought that it was effective. I actually liked his lair. And I thought his battle with the giant snake was pretty good. I liked the creepy, good-looking men and women that are watching him battle the snake. Again, it's kind of become a James Bond trope, but I think it is equally effective here. Incidentally, that jungle scene that was used at Drax's fortress hideout, that is known as the Twin Pyramids at the complex of Tikal in Guatemala, and it was used in another famous movie. So take a look at the scene with the pyramid in the jungle, and those very woods and that pyramid was used to represent the moon of Yavin in Star Wars, aka Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope. So when they said that they were copying Star Wars, they really weren't kidding. So then comes the finale of this movie, the space scene. Bond blasts off into space where he and a squadron of space marines battle Drax's space army with laser guns. You heard that right. It is insane. Although this time around, I did start wondering, I mean, is this any more ludicrous than a spaceship that eats space capsules or a base underneath a volcano or a tarot card reading psychic? Well, probably not. But those elements were kind of lodged inside good movies, And had this film been played more straight, I don't know, I think we could have been a little more invested in the space sequence. However, amidst hovering gondolas, you know, a cowboy dressed 007, and a dozen cheap gags, the finale is kind of ludicrous. So, you know, if you're watching this movie, you really can't take this last space battle scene too seriously. You know, the scene really does become so bad that it really becomes good. And, you know, every time a space marine shoots his gun and it causes this little blue cartoon laser flash with a little cartoon explosion when it hits a person, I just couldn't stop chuckling each time. I mean, it was so bad that it was really entertaining me. Now, finally, you know, this big epic battle happens. And incidentally, while making this movie, it actually set the record for the most number of actors that were on wires. So it is... Well, it can't be ridiculous. It also is a pretty good spectacle. I gotta admit, I don't know, this time around, I really did enjoy myself watching this film. So, I guess you have to be in the right frame of mind. Now, finally, in the last scene, you know, three satellite probes with poison on it, like a deadly virus, escape, and James Bond and Holly Goodhead has to follow it with the Moonraker shuttle and destroy the three probes. Now, they destroy the first two, but the third one, you know, right before it's about to detonate, you know, Bond has difficulty targeting it with the computer because the computer targeting system malfunctions due to the heat of reentry. And then he says, switching to manual, and then he has to use his instincts to destroy the probe. Sound familiar? You know, I practically heard Q's voice saying something like, James, use the Force! You know, so when they said they were borrowing heavily from Star Wars, I mean, they really weren't kidding. And the more you think about it, the just the more ridiculous it is. But again, if you get in that right frame of mind, I think you can actually enjoy this movie. Now, the next podcast, we're going to talk about one of my all-time favorite James Bond films, because this Bond film is what turned me into a James Bond fan. And that's the movie For Your Eyes Only. Whatever you think of this movie, most critics will say that this is Roger Moore's best performance as James Bond. Now, we all know that For Your Eyes Only was supposed to be the movie after Spy Who Loved Me, instead of this film. But since Bond was trend-hopping on the success of Star Wars, they made Moonraker. So most Bond fans actually say, we could have had For Your Eyes Only next, but instead we got this. Well, I'm not sure that's a valid point. And the reason why is, I think that they made For Your Eyes Only as a response to what they saw as a failure and the campiness of Moonraker. And I think the campiness of this movie made them return to a smaller, more serious James Bond. So I think that if they made For Your Eyes Only right after The Spy Who Loved Me, I think it's quite possible we would have had a Lewis Gilbert-directed For Your Eyes Only. We probably would have still had the return of Jaws. We would have probably still had Jaws get a girlfriend and turn into a good guy. We probably still would have had the gondola on wheels. For Your Eyes Only, instead of the final assault on St. Cyril's, we probably would have had some giant futuristic citadel that James Bond has to penetrate. So I think we should thank Moonraker for helping us get the excellent For Your Eyes Only that we did end up getting. So please join me next week when we discuss For Your Eyes Only. And that concludes my podcast. I thank you so much for listening.